From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, President Trump and two Republican senators announced a plan that would drastically change America's immigration system, rewarding skilled workers who speak English far more and stopping families from pulling each other across the border.
The RAISE Act ends chain migration and replaces our low-skilled system with a new points-based system for receiving a green card. This competitive application process will favor applicants who can speak English, financially support themselves and their families, and demonstrate skills that will contribute to our economy.
This merit system plan was written by Senators Tom Cotton and David Perdue. They call it the first major U.S. immigration overhaul in half a century. NPR's congressional reporter Jeff Bennett is on the line. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Robin.
So these senators say they want to get immigration back to historical norms. What do they mean by that? And tell us more about how they plan to do that.
Well, you know, the Migration Policy Institute says the percentage of foreign-born Americans today is about what it was in 1910. So this picture they paint of a country being overrun by immigrants just isn't borne out in the data. But, you know, their bill is really an updated version of legislation they floated back in February. Mm-hmm. It didn't gain any traction in the Senate. And so what you heard the president talk about today, these three pillars, the speak English, financially support yourself, contribute to the economy, those three pillars for new immigrants coming into the country under this legislation, those three things are born out of the original bill, which ultimately seeks to replace the existing system, the existing legal immigration system, which privileges family members of current U.S. residents, and replacing it with one that favors immigrants with specific skills, this merit-based, point-based immigration system, which you referenced
right
earlier. And the president says, you know, he endorses it because he thinks that he sort of explained his support for it as a way to protect American workers, who he says are hurt by unskilled workers who would do the same work as Americans, but for lower wages.
Well, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas said that about 1 million green cards are issued every year, but the majority of those workers drag down the economy. Let's listen.
In fact, only one in 15 out of 1 million new immigrants come here because of their job skills and their ability to succeed in this economy. That means it puts great downward pressure on people who work with their hands and work on their feet.
So his point, Jeff, there being that those 1 in 15 are the highly skilled, the other 14 are not, and those other 14 are the ones dragging down the wages for U.S. workers. Of course, people who have studied these things have said that in many cases, U.S. workers don't want those jobs. But
right,
they also talked about banning new immigrants and refugees, banning welfare for new immigrants and refugees. One wonders how do they live here, you know, without some of that traditional help. What are the chances of this passing? If, as you said, in February, it didn't get traction.
Well, and to your point, this has been litigated time and time again. Here's the thing. I mean, Cotton and Senator Perdue face really entrenched opposition in the Senate, and it's not just from Democrats. You have immigration-friendly Republicans, folks like Marco Rubio, John McCain. You have pro-immigrant Democrats, and then you have business lobbies that favor high immigration rates. And so the original bill aimed to cut illegal immigration in half. So that is what these folks are up against, and it's one of the reasons why the political calculus here, I think, is pretty transparent, that this is a pitch to President Trump's base of conservative Republicans.
Yeah. I just want to touch on health care because there's some deadlines this week, and today we're hearing from Republicans like Lamar Alexander, who chairs the Senate Health Care Committee, saying that he's going to hold bipartisan hearings with Democrats to fix Obamacare instead of repealing it. President Trump saying he still wants the Affordable Care Act repealed and replaced. Last night, a court sided with states suing to keep their subsidies for the poor from being taken away, as the president threatened. And he has to make a decision this week on what he's going to do with those subsidies to insurance companies. What do you see happening here with Republicans seeming to say they're going to end run him?
And Republicans realize they've hit a wall with this effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. You mentioned the hearings that Lamar Alexander is going to hold with Patty Murray, the top Democrat on the Health Committee. Guess when those hearings start? They start in September, not in August. Remember, the president wanted the Senate to get on board with this repeal effort before they left for their delayed August recess. The Senate Majority Leader has already said he's laid out the agenda items, and health care is nowhere on that list. So, and John Cornyn, who's in Republican leadership, said on the Senate floor yesterday, Robin, that the only viable path for some sort of health care fix is a bipartisan one. So while there are Republicans in the party, and there are certainly Republicans in the White House who want to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, that is not happening, at least as it stands right now. And so the most concrete, the most serious effort to replace to fix the Affordable Care Act was probably going to come out of the Senate. There's also an effort happening in the House.
Yeah.
But this Senate bill, the Senate effort, is a short-term fix so that people who have to buy insurance on the exchanges next year can do so in a way that's affordable.
NPR congressional reporter Jeff Bennett, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, here's another thing the Trump administration wants to do. It wants to get rid of rules that would protect water and communities from fracking on federal lands. Among other things, the regulations require oil and gas companies to disclose the chemicals they're using. They were proposed by the Obama administration but have been held up in court since 2015. And last week, the Bureau of Land Management officially proposed nixing the rules. Now, scientists have found that people who live near hydraulic fracturing sites are more likely to experience health problems, and that has fueled speculation that the fracking process is to blame. But one researcher thinks the problem might be coming from another source. Reed Frazier of Here and Now contributor The Allegheny Front explains.
Mike McCauley is a West Virginia University professor of environmental health. When he started studying fracking a few years ago, he began hearing stories from residents and medical professionals in fracking areas of children getting asthma and an increase in cardiovascular disease.
That's usually considered a sentinel event when people start saying, well, I'm noticing this upswing. So it's not proof positive, but it's something to make you sit up and take a closer look.
These anecdotes were followed by government-funded studies showing similar trends, like an uptick in hospitalization, asthma, and premature birth in fracking areas. But they couldn't explain why these effects were happening. McCauley knew that some of these symptoms are common to people exposed to diesel fumes. He thought these health impacts may be tied to diesel emissions at the well pad itself, from equipment used to drill and frack for natural gas. Then a few years ago, he had an epiphany, standing in a town in northeastern Pennsylvania during the height of the fracking boom.
And about every 45 seconds, there was a heavy-duty diesel truck came by. And it didn't matter what the time of day was.
Diesel engines emit a large number of tiny solid and liquid masses called ultrafine particles. These particles are so small they can fit inside the pores of a human cell, says McCauley. And once inside a cell, can cause problems. Diesel pollution is linked to heart and lung disease and cancer. So McCauley began testing the air along roads near fracking sites in West Virginia on a grant from the Department of Energy. And he saw concentrations of ultrafine particles similar to what you would find in a big city or near a highway. He says that makes sense, since each gas well requires between 4,000 and 6,000 truck trips to haul equipment and materials to the well site.
Here comes one.
In Scenery Hill in Washington County, Pennsylvania, Lois Bauer Bjornson can tell a truck is coming up the road the next valley over. Bauer Bjornson and her husband moved here from Pittsburgh 13 years ago with their young children. She became an environmental activist after watching 33 wells get built within a 3-mile radius of her house. She said she knew the state highway her house was on had plenty of traffic when she moved in, but it wasn't like this.
When it was busy, it would be in the mornings and the evenings for like what we call rush hour, but not what it is now. It's endless, and you've got massive trucks. Whether they're residual waste trucks, freshwater trucks, the crane trucks, just everything you need for a well pad is trucked in.
The gas industry says it's cutting down on emissions from trucks at well sites. Seth Whitehead is with the industry group Energy In Depth. He says companies are using more equipment and vehicles that run on natural gas, which is cleaner burning than diesel. And in some areas, they're trying to use fewer trucks to bring in the millions of gallons of water needed to hydraulically fracture the gas-rich rocks where they're drilling.
Where several wells are located in close proximity, it's now common for companies to use freshwater ponds that use water pipelines rather than trucks to get water to hydraulic fracturing sites.
Still, he says, diesel trucks remain indispensable for the industry.
Our society as a whole is always trying to find a way to minimize emissions. At the same time, we have to produce the energy that we need to power our economy in this country. So it's definitely, I think, a balance.
Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection has limits on truck idling and says air quality in drilling regions meets federal standards. But the state's monitors aren't measuring those ultrafine particles scientist Mike McCauley is concerned about. McCauley says we could find public health impacts farther away from wells than previously thought. Though he says it's understandable that attention has been focused at the well pads.
If your kids are sick or your grandparents are sick or you're not feeling so well yourself, to say, ah, it must be that well pad because I can see that well pad and it's got its lights on all night long and we should be going after that. In fact, ignore the truck that's rumbling past your house.
McCauley's using satellite data and lab analysis to test his hypothesis. Those results could come out in the next year or two. For Here and Now, I'm Reed Frazier.
And it's been a dramatic rise for Brett Young. His single, In Case You Didn't Know, is now number 2 on the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart. But not long ago, even country fans probably hadn't heard of him. He's now on tour with his debut studio album, and Brett Young joins us from Tampa. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And let's start with the song that if people have heard of you, they've probably heard this song. This is In Case You Didn't Know. Even though I don't tell you all the time, you had my heart a long, long time ago. In case you didn't know. So tell us what this song is about, first of all.
Well, I think most guys can relate to being bad at expressing their feelings. And this one came about kind of funny for us because it was originally a conversation that we were having about one of the other writers, Trent Tomlinson, and something that him and his mom had when he was a kid where every time he'd leave the house, she'd stop him on his way out the door and say, "Hey, Trent, in case you didn't know, I love you." We thought, how sweet is that, right? But also, we probably don't want to write a song about your mom. So let's try to figure out how we're going to twist that. And I think that was the common thread that we could all kind of relate to was, you know, being men and being bad at expressing our feelings. And you know, for the most part, it's not even that we don't want to say the things that women need to hear. We're just bad at it, and we're aware of that.
So well, you're the one singing it. I mean, have you had that experience?
You know, as a songwriter, I think I tend to be a little bit more on the like emotional side as far as men go. But yeah, I do. I think that men and women are wired very differently, and you know, you can very innocently and unintentionally you know, omit things that you know the other party needs to hear. And yeah, I'm sure I've been on that end of it.
We've read that you didn't necessarily think you would be a musician. You were more into baseball. You were a pitcher in college. What happened? How did you get into this line of work?
Yeah, no, baseball was a big part of most of my life. But I think growing up in the church and listening to music and playing music just kind of because that's what you did growing up in church and in Christian school, it was always kind of a part of me. But baseball was the biggest part of me. And it took, you know, a career-ending elbow injury in college for me to have to kind of, you know, put life back in focus and figure out what it was that was going to make me happy. And it was when I hurt myself, there's a large amount of depression that goes along with, you know, a career-ending injury mm-hmm. like that when you think it's going to be your whole life. And music just at the very beginning of it all became kind of an outlet for that.
So even before that, were you a fan of country music?
I was. The first country song that ever really pulled me into the genre was Tim McGraw, Don't Take the Girl. Only reason I even heard that is because I have an older sister and I was being an annoying little brother who had the front seat and control of the radio one day. And she didn't like country music at the time. And the only way, you know, I could bother her because she was busy back there kicking the back of my chair to bother me was to blast some country radio. And I thought I was doing it to bother her, but the joke was on me because Don't Take the Girl came on and I fell in love. And I think that was like 93. And so I've been a country music fan ever since.
I go through country music phases here and there. And of course, every time I ever go to Nashville, I've got to be playing country music in the car. But you're from California.
Yeah. You know, I was one of the first one of my friends to find country music. And I got a little bit made fun of for it, you know, back then. But it was interesting to be, you know, going to the beach and surfing every day and then driving home and listening to country music. But that was kind of my jam.
Now, you have your guitar with you.
I do.
And can you play something for us?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of my favorite songs off of this record is the last one. And I think it's maybe one of the saddest songs on the record, too. So I apologize for that. But it's a song called Mercy.
Mercy, why you gotta show up looking so good just to hurt me? And why you wanna stop this whole damn world from turning? Mercy, why you hanging on so tight if this ain't working? And why you wanna stop this flame if it's still burning? It's still burning. So if you're gonna break my heart, just break it. And if you're gonna take your shot, then take it. Take it. If you made up your mind, then make it. Or make this fast. If you ever love me, have mercy. If you go out tonight and get drunk and lonely, wind up home alone, please don't call me and say you miss me, no. So if you're gonna break my heart, just break it. And if you're gonna take your shot, then take it. Take it. If you made up your mind, then make this fast. If you ever love me, have mercy. Whoa, whoa, have mercy. If you're gonna break my heart, just break it. If you're gonna take your shot, then take it. Take it. Oh, if you're gonna break my heart, just break it. And if you're gonna take your shot, then take it. Take it. If you made up your mind, then make it. Make this fast. If you ever love me, if you ever love me, have mercy. Oh, have mercy, Lord, have mercy. Have mercy.
Wow. Thank you so much. Brett Young doing Mercy right there. Now, why is that the last song on the album?
You know, I always feel like as a music consumer, I always want that, like, that kind of slow, stripped down personal song to close out the record just when I'm the one listening. And so we put it there on purpose for that reason. But also, that song wasn't going to make the record. We had 11 songs already completely picked out. We had put out originally a 6-song EP. And when we went to finish the record, we found out that there's just a thing with iTunes where when you put out the rest of the record, it has to be at least twice as long as the EP. And it was like a very happy accident because in the 11th hour, I got to sneak my favorite song onto the record because of a technicality. And so it was not only the last one to make the record. Also, I just wanted to put that really personal song, that stripped down one at the end.
I noticed you got a Get Drunk reference in there. Is that a rule in country music that there has to be some reference to beer or getting drunk?
You know, that seems to be everywhere, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
I realize in country music, we probably are the quickest to talk about that. But I think, you know, in heartbreak, that, I think that's pretty universal in terms of in life, you know? And so I think country's really comfortable to say it, but I think everybody can relate.
Well, you've also said that you want to make music that parents and kids can both listen to, that's mature without being offensive. Why do you think that's so important?
I just decided, regardless of what, you know, what it was that I did for a living, if I ever was in the public eye, that I wanted to be one of those people that, you know, and specifically with music, where, you know, a mom might have a 13-year-old daughter and wants to go to a country music show but doesn't have to leave her daughter at home because she's uncomfortable about the content. You know, I just never understood why lines had to be blurred in order to get messages across.
Do you remember the first show that you went to?
I do. My very first concert ever was Boys to Men and Mariah Carey.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was Boys to Men was and still are some of my favorite singers.
Huh. You sound nothing like Boys to Men.
No, I certainly don't.
Do you try to take anything from them?
You know, I do think that there's, you know, in my house growing up, my parents were big fans of soul music, you know, so I listened to a lot of, you know, Smokey Robinson or, you know, Gary Puckett and the Union Gap or, you know, Sam Cooke and things like that. And some of those have spilled over into my style of singing.
Let me ask you one more question. I mean, your song, in case you didn't know, is now right up at the top of the Billboard country charts. What's been the most unbelievable moment for you of all of this success you've had?
You know, for me, the coolest thing is to have a song, not only that you perform as an artist and that's on your record and that you've sent to radio, but a song that you wrote as well, to have that sung back to you when you're on stage. And the coolest time that's happened was when I got to go back and play my hometown. A couple months back, we played the Hollywood Bowl. And that was a huge bucket list venue for me.
It's a great venue.
It's just incredible. I grew up going to concerts there. And so to walk out as the first of three and have it be full was already incredible. But then to have all my friends and family and my hometown crowd singing one of my songs back to me, I think that was the coolest experience I've had so far. I would be lying if I said
that I could live this life without you, even though. That's Brett Young. His new self-titled album is out now. He's also on tour. You can learn more at hereandnow.org. Brett Young, great pleasure having you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, to be an arborist and climb where you haven't dared since you were a child, maybe not even then. But for arborists, it's serious. That's what Carmel Doshad of Here Now contributor WAMU discovered this past weekend at an international tree climbing competition in Washington, D.C.
The red oak tree in front of me was big, as in 100 feet high big, the kind you see in movies with giant swings hanging down from its wide branches. Somewhere inside its limbs is an arborist competing in the Master's Challenge of the International Tree Climbing Championship.
I really love doing the kind of dynamic swings in the tree.
That's Jocelyn Losey. She's one of 67 competitors from nearly 20 countries and the Mid-Atlantic champion. As Losey and I watch the competition unfold, we talk about what it takes to make it to the international level.
What is the hardest part about it, would you say? Not falling?
Well, yeah, you definitely want to try not to fall. It's just really physically demanding, I think.
But there's a wider purpose beyond the race to the top of an oak tree, says Andrew Dunavant, another competitor.
Get outside and see what's out there. I love the outdoors. I love being in trees. That's the best part of my day, is being up in a tree and just enjoying the quiet, the nature part of it, and just caring for the environment versus tearing it down.
He says it underscores that nature is still at the center of everything arborists do. People of all ages and backgrounds sit on colorful blankets in the grass, watching the competition. Felipe Benitez was one of them.
I love hugging trees. I mean, it really changes your perspective. Just being a few feet up the ground, you see things in a different way. You feel the air feels different. You hear sounds that are different. You see habitats that are different.
Benitez works with a group that encourages those in Spanish-speaking communities to get out and enjoy nature. But most of all, he wants people from all walks of life to appreciate it.
when you get out the door today and you see that tree, would you walk by every day, either to get to your place of work or to your car, hug that tree. Thank that tree for all the things that it does for you, because it is a lot.
Hugging a tree might be a bit cliche, but Benita seems to say it with all sincerity. And while I didn't run towards a tree with open arms, I was interested in seeing what it was like to climb one.
You're going to step 1 foot down into here. It goes on kind of like a pair of weird pants.
I put one foot through a harness as Aurora Hatsock walks me through Tree Climbing 101. She's running the fun climb at the event with, luckily for me, a much smaller tree.
Now I got to grab this rope here.
Right, you're going to take the knot.
I make it about 4 feet off the ground, and Hatsock shows me what it's like to swing from the branches like Tarzan. Getting up here was harder than it looks. It took a lot of balance and upper body strength, not to mention coordination, all things I admittedly struggle with.
Watch out, here she comes. Now this is the nice relaxing mode. We can also go transition into rocket mode. Watch out, don't let me hit the throw. All right, so for rocket mode, we usually count it down. 3, 2,
oh, you did?
I see why it's called rocket mode.
I swing higher as Hatsock pulls a rope tethering me to the tree harder. After about 15 minutes, I head down to solid ground.
Carmel, you are amazing.
Do I have a future in this?
I hope so.
You hesitated a little.
No, I hope that you choose to have a future in it. I think that tree climbing can be really a fun part of anybody's life.
At the very least, I enjoyed the perspective of being several feet up a tree, even if it was brief. For Here and Now, I'm Carmel Dalshad.
Recently, one of the Bibles of journalists, the AP Style Book, added a section about addiction. It says that reporters should describe the 21 million addicted Americans as people with addiction, not addicts. Use substance use disorder instead of substance abuser. Why? And why is it important to call methadone a medical treatment, not a sub for heroin? Well, because a recent World Health Organization study found that drug addiction is the most stigmatized of social problems. And there's a move to try to get people to see it as the brain disease it is and not a bad habit. Let's hear more about that from Michael Botticelli, the former director of national drug policy under President Obama. Just before leaving his office in January, Michael issued a memorandum on how federal agencies should refer to addiction. Not to be politically correct, but because it affects the way people are treated and whether they seek treatment at all. Michael Botticelli is now executive director of the Graykin Center for Addiction Medicine at Boston Medical Center. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's good to be here.
And start with your memorandum. I have it in front of me. Why? Why did you ask all agencies to change the way they speak?
So you cited when you started this story the nearly 21 million Americans who have a substance use disorder, and unfortunately, only a very small percentage, about 10% of those people, actually get treatment. And when you look at the reasons that people cite of why they don't seek treatment, the number one answer that comes up for many people is stigma. They don't want their neighbors finding out. They don't want their friends finding out. And one of the contributory factors to that stigma is our language that we use. So this is not just a polite thing to do. These are issues and these are words that have a dramatic impact on both clinical care and about how medical professionals actually see and treat people with addiction.
Well, this is the same kind of move that we heard with other language. You know, people with autism, instead of calling them the disorder, calling them autistics, the idea was they are people first and then there is something that they have.
Correct. And often when we call people things like addict or junkies, not only are they incredibly judgmental words, but they also kind of pigeonhole someone's entire being to that one single characteristic. And again, this is where we're beginning to have much more direct clinical evidence that words matter. And Dr. John Kelly, who's at the Harvard MGH Recovery Research Institute, did this really interesting study where he gave trained clinicians nearly identical scenarios about someone with a substance use disorder. And the only thing he changed was in one scenario, he called the person a substance abuser. And in the other scenario, a person with a substance abuse disorder. And what he found is when you called someone a substance abuser, it elicited, even from trained clinicians, a much more punitive response.
Yeah, in other words, they are the ones who should be punished for their behavior, as opposed to when you use the substance use disorder, which is the new phrase, they have something. It's a disorder. It's not a failing.
It's not a failing. And again, I think, you know, now we have language that comports with our understanding of addiction as the disease, not as a moral failing, not as a character flaw. A word like abuse, it implies volition. It implies intent. And not to say that people with addiction don't make choices. It negates the fact that they have a disease and they need treatment. And not only does that impact on the individual level, it impacts on the policy level. So you think about our history of how we treat people with addiction. And largely it's been with punitive criminal justice responses, not with, you know, robust health responses to this. You know, from my standpoint, this is one of the simple things that we can do, I think, that will have a direct impact on how people perceive themselves and the care that people get.
Well, we have seen language change in the past, but boy, I'm wondering if this will be simple. First of all, you're suggesting what the current Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders is already doing. Mm-hmm. So you're telling people, and agencies are now telling us all, let's switch from abuser or addict to this substance use disorder. Mm-hmm. It's hard to see somebody, you know, wrestling with having this, sitting in, let's say, a 12-step meeting, and instead of saying, I'm an addict, saying, I'm someone with a substance use disorder. You've already got 10 more words.
Yeah. So I think language changes are always hard initially, that, you know, we're going through an adaptation period. You know, I make mistakes all the time, you know, and I fall back into kind of habitual language. And so it takes time. But I think that part of it is we need to continue to make conscious effort. You talked about autism, but think about words that we used to describe someone with a mental illness that we don't use anymore.
The R word, we won't even
the
say.
The R word people don't say anymore. Mm-hmm. So we need to be able to do that. And, you know, the other piece too, which I think is important, I'm also a person in long-term recovery, and I realize sometimes what I say is we use our 12-step language in public ways that is probably not beneficial. So what we say to each other or what we say in the context of a meeting is different than what we should be saying in the public, because people in the general public hear those words dramatically different
right.
than someone who's sharing the same journey with me.
So you're asking for person with a substance use disorder instead of a junkie.
Instead of a junkie, instead of a drunk, instead of a substance abuser. You know, I think all of us realize that that's a mouthful. But we could even say a person with addiction, right, instead of an addict. You know, we also, I think, use other words and terminology that are somehow easier to change. Like often we talk about people in recovery as being clean. Right. Well, you know, you think of what the opposite of that means is that
dirty.
When they're active, they're dirty. So
what would you do there? Positive and negative?
Oh, in recovery, not in recovery.
And you're saying apply it also to drug tests, you know, not clean or dirty, but what?
Positive and negative. I don't know of other drug tests that we describe in such judgmental language. I was actually just looking at results of an interesting study that Johns Hopkins did about the public opinion about mental health and substance use disorders. And they asked people things like, are people with a substance use disorder or a mental illness deserving of treatment? Unfortunately, even more than mental health, people said that someone with a substance use disorder shouldn't be entitled to treatment. They shouldn't be entitled to housing. They shouldn't be entitled to employment, even more than people with a mental health illness. And what it shows me is we have a ways to go on both illnesses. But it also says that even more than mental illnesses, we need to continue to diminish some of the stigma that contributes to some of those public policy and public sentiment.
You talk about medication-assisted treatment as well. So talk about this, because some people might not be aware of what you are seeing as the negative use of words like substitution. So when somebody's under treatment, they say methadone is substituting for heroin, and that says what to you? Why is that wrong?
So that basically says to me that people still have an active addiction, even though they are using one of the most evidence-based medications that we have. Addiction is a constellation of symptoms. People are not committing crimes. You know, they have improvement in social functions. They have an improvement in employment. And there's a dramatic difference between using an illicit substance to get high versus a medication to treat your disease. We would never say to a diabetic who's getting insulin, you're supporting your disease with a drug. I'm a former smoker, and I've never heard someone say to me that wearing a patch is just substituting for smoking. It's not. It's actually become the standard of treatment. And unfortunately, there's additional stigma attached to people on medication. And think about that. Think about a person who might be struggling, who might be saying, you know, I think I might want to go to treatment, who sees that and basically says, oh, my God, I don't want to be stigmatized like that.
So Michael Botticelli, what's been the reaction of the treatment community, of the federal government? There were some who were even trying to change the agencies because the agencies have abuse right in the title.
Yeah. I think the reaction from our federal agencies was incredibly positive on this. I hope people experienced a robust response from the Obama administration as it related to this epidemic from many, many of our federal agencies. And so I think they saw this as something they could contribute to. Unfortunately, some of our federal agencies that actually have drug abuse or substance abuse in their names are actually statutorily mandated names. They actually would have to pass legislation to change their name. So it wasn't, unfortunately, just a simple process of some of those agencies just changing their name.
Right.
And, you know, when the AP style book changes came out, I felt especially proud because one of the reasons that we did what we did at the federal level was in hopes of modeling other changes with the media, with the public for those kinds of language changes. So I don't know how the Trump administration has been looking at that document or holding federal agencies to that kind of piece. But I am glad to see that there seems to be growing understanding and acceptance of clinically appropriate non-stigmatizing language.
That's Michael Botticelli, director of the National Drug Control Policy under President Obama, and he is now executive director of the Graykin Center for Addiction Medicine at Boston Medical Center. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, your thoughts. Person with substance use disorder, not an addict or a junkie, weigh in. We'd love to hear from you at hereandnow.org. Quick note, tomorrow, workers at the Nissan Auto Assembly Plant in Canton, Mississippi, begin voting on whether to join the United Auto Workers Union, which has never unionized a Southern plant. We'll hear more this afternoon on All Things Considered. That's ATC this afternoon.
And if you're at the point in the summer where you need some new ideas for the grill, Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst has some thoughts on slow cooking meat. She joins us in the studio. Kathy, explain.
If you're grilling a steak, you get your grill nice and hot, you throw the steak on, 6, 8, 10 minutes later, you're done. What we're going to talk about today is really different. These are fatty cuts of meat that are meant to be cooked very slowly and steadily.
Who are you calling fatty?
Not you, but the stuff on your plate was once. So I'm talking about ribs. I'm talking about brisket. I'm talking about short ribs. Those kind of amazing fatty meats that we don't want to eat too much of. And we tend to think of as winter food, but in fact, slow grilling them and smoking them on a plain old regular grill like you have in your backyard, like you have on your fire escape, you can achieve incredible results.
So don't use a gas grill.
Don't I sound like an 800 number?
You do.
You too. You can use a gas grill. You will miss out on some of the smoky flavor that one gets from good charcoal.
All right. Well, let's try this brisket here. This is the sort of thing that restaurants take hours to cook.
As did I.
Yes. Can you create that flavor at home?
Give it a bite. I'll tell you. So let's talk about beef brisket. You want to look for something called the second cut, which is the fattier piece. Rub it with some ground cumin seeds, good sea salt, and ground peppercorns, little bit of light brown sugar. How did I do? He's chewing. He's nodding. Okay, good.
It's delicious.
All right. So you rub some spices on the meat and you let it sit there. And then you set up your fire. Whether you're using charcoal or gas, you want to set something up called indirect heat. You light one side of the grill. So if you're using charcoal, which I hope you will, you're going to pour all the hot charcoals to one side. Mm. Let's say it's the left side. So the right side has nothing under it. That's the indirect zone. It's going to benefit from the heat, but not be right on top of it. So you're going to cook the brisket in a pan with the spices on it.
On the side that does not have charcoal.
Exactly. Not direct heat. And you're going to cook it long and slow. You want your barbecue to be at about 300 degrees. If your grill does not have a built-in thermometer, it would be a great idea to get to a hardware store and buy a cheap thermometer so that you can regulate the temperature of your grill.
And do you throw anything else into the grill besides the charcoal?
You do. So what you do is you buy something called wood chips, because that's exactly what they are. They're just chips of wood, and you want something that's meant specifically for grilling so that it's organic or natural and doesn't have anything on it. You soak the wood chips in water, and then just before you're ready to put the meat on the grill, you remove the soaked wood chips from the water, you wrap them in foil, poke a few holes in it, and put it directly on top of the hot coals. So the heat of the fire is going to heat up these chips, and you're going to create a smoky oven. It can take anywhere from 3 hours, honestly, to 8 hours, and it is going to be juicy, and it is going to be fork tender, meaning you'd barely need a knife to eat this brisket. Mm-hmm. So do you need anything with it? Well, it's pretty fabulous on its own, but this is my, I very modestly call this best barbecue sauce, right? Mm. It's ketchup based. It's got chopped ginger and garlic. It's got Chinese chili paste. It's got sriracha or a hot chili sauce in it. And it's got some balsamic vinegar and soy sauce in it and maple syrup. So it's got all the elements. It's sweet, it's spicy, it's sour. And I think it kind of complements that smoky, slightly fatty, tender meat.
And if you order it now,
yes,
you will get a squeegee as well.
1-800 here and now.
So you've got some ribs here as well.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Okay, so these are pork ribs. You can look for St. Louis style, mm-hmm, or baby back ribs. And this is my husband John Rudolph's recipe. He created this rub of brown sugar, chili powder, ground cumin, thyme, oregano, coriander, and you pack the spices on the rib, and you get the fire set up exactly as I described for the brisket. Indirect heat, slow cooking. These ribs are fatty. They're going to baste, but you'll see by the time you're done, 3-4 hours later, they're crisp on the outside. They're meaty. Also, what I do when I make these ribs is I use mesquite or fruit wood chips, the wood chips we talked about, but I will baste it after an hour or two with apple cider or apple juice or cranberry, or I use cherry juice just to keep it moist so they don't dry out.
And they go perfectly with this slaw that you made.
They do. So, you know, this meat, as I've said, is rich, so you want something light. So I call this my Asian slaw. It's Napa cabbage, thinly sliced snow peas, red pepper, and then the real burst of flavor comes from the dressing, which is chopped up fresh ginger, sesame oil, soy sauce, vegetable oil, and peanuts for a crunch. You know, that meat, if you eat a lot of that meat, you're going to start to need an afternoon nap, which is not a bad idea, but the slaw will help wake you up.
Cancel my afternoon interviews.
All right, everything's done. My fault.
Kathy Gunst, our resident chef at Here and Now. We will put all of these recipes at our website, hereandnow.org. Kathy, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. That is the best slaw. It's Here and Now.